My name's Ian Jenkins. I'm currently a debt and benefits advisor, but previously I was an academic in an English department in a Russell League university. Before that, I've worked in various things. I've been sort of an activist of various kinds for many years, mainly sort of economic reform, and I was one of the founders of the Merthyr Rising Festival, which was a sort of left-wing festival of ideas. The idea of it being that it was wide open and that, you know, it was complete free speech and that all topics could be debated, which, as you can imagine, led to me receiving endless abuse.
Well, that's right. The left wing are very, very good at that. I was up at the Wigan Diggers Festival on Saturday,
right,
to hear that the various Trotsky factions had actually come to blows at the beginning of the day,
right,
and the organisers had to intervene to stop the police having to intervene. This is the left wing getting together and having a party.
So the People's Front of Judea had another fight with the Judean People's Front today.
That's right, and it was all over President Assad because somebody had an article on the newspaper on one of their stalls talking about Assad as a democratically elected president and a reasonable guy.
Right, God forbid that anybody should say such things, even when he was elected by the people of his country.
Anyway, look, Ian, I'd like to have a little chat with you, if you don't mind, about the so-called pandemic. Is it something you refer to as a pandemic?
No, because really on the metrics, it isn't one. For one thing, it would need to be everywhere and isn't. But also, I mean, I think now looking at the figures, if the WHO hadn't changed the definition of a pandemic before the H1N1 situation to remove the requirement for mass deaths, it never would have been declared a pandemic. Also, of course, the way in which deaths have been recorded based on a PCR test, and then, you know, also that then being made a notifiable disease, even though it wasn't a disease of high consequence, resulted in probably a great deal of deaths being recorded that weren't due to the particular pathogen. But
one of the big scandals for me is this whole thing, and, you know, for the first probably 10 months of the COVID crisis, we can call it, there was supposed to be no treatment. And even when it was revealed that it can be treated to stop people having to be hospitalised, that has been completely blocked by the press. Any idea of treatment? In fact, there's an article just on the BBC today talking about one of the most effective treatments against COVID, which is ivermectin, as why are people talking about this horse drug? And this is the BBC saying this.
Well, I suppose when somebody's eating their oats in the morning, they could talk about them eating horse food. But, I mean, you know, a chemical is a chemical. It has efficacy or it doesn't. You know, that's how pharmaceuticals work. There are a lot of pharmaceuticals we take that are also taken by dogs, horses, cats, and a variety of other fauna. But, you know, I mean, touching there really on just the censorship issue, nothing has been discussed. Nothing. I mean, if science is the process of having debate, you know, in order to seek the truth, then that hasn't happened in any way. I've failed to see how it's happened. I mean, I'm not a scientist, but I've studied, you know, philosophy of science and scientific method, and I can't see any sign of that having happened. I mean, I was sort of familiar with this way of conducting science through the climate change narrative, where, you know, the settled science there conducts itself in exactly the same way, you know, which frankly is in a way that would make, you know, Lysenko blush.
Interestingly, Prince Charles is connected very, very much into both of these.
Yeah, well,
climate agenda. And
a lot of people are, aren't they?
with the Great Reset. I mean, well, I mean, as a key person in both of those two, you know, we got Klaus Schwab and Prince Charles as the two main people in the Great Reset, and also one of the key people beneficiaries financially and has been pushing it since the Rio Earth Summit is Prince Charles.
Well, who would have thunk it? You know, I mean, obviously the people that push both of those, what do you want to call them, theories, agendas, are the ones who stand to benefit most in terms of profits, power. It, you know, there is a cast of characters that appear to circulate around both. Both in terms of being instigators and propagators, you know, or disseminators of the ideas. You know, it didn't take long into the, this, let's say, pandemic, for sake of a better word, before Greta Thunberg popped up. I wasn't aware that she was an expert on infectious disease, but it didn't take long. There she was, you know, and she's there now busily promoting the jabs. I don't necessarily call them vaccines. But, yeah, there does seem to be a sort of cast of characters that are involved in both of those. But, I mean, in terms of what we were talking on previously, the methods, the way in which it is discussed, the way that science has been presented is similar in both, because in both you have no dialogue, you have no debate, you have censorship, you have dissenting voices abused, silenced, their credentials questioned, even when their credentials are impeccable. You can have somebody who's a Nobel Prize winner and they'll be getting called a conspiracy theorist. You could have somebody who's a former vice president of research for Pfizer getting called a conspiracy theorist, when clearly, you know, some of these people who've spoken up have nothing to gain from it professionally, financially, in terms of their own circles. You know, a lot of them are retired, were living perfectly quiet lives, but didn't feel that they could be silent about it. And, you know, I mean, apart from anything else, it's just not how science is conducted. It isn't conducted by fiat. It isn't conducted by the issuing of scientific papal bulls. It's a constant process of dialogue, discovery, refutation, theory, counter theory. That hasn't happened. That hasn't been present.
Well, something else has happened instead, and that is a whole bunch of edicts from Sage and NerveTag, uncritically reported by the mass media. And the mass media, of course, I used to be part of a mini mass media here in Bristol. But we're 18 months down the line here. We're now at a very important juncture where the government advisors, Ian, have said that they don't want the youngest of our population to have this vaccine. They don't think that they are actually liable to be harmed by COVID-19. And yet the government has overridden that. And Chris Whitty, who, you know, to be as unbiased as I can to him, looks like a sort of love child of Voldemort and Gollum, you know.
He's a beautiful individual.
He doesn't have any children himself, by the way, has said that actually we should be vaccinating children now.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen that as well, haven't we? I mean, that's been a sort of running thing as well. Even within their own narrative of follow the science, if that science then says something they don't want it to say, it suddenly doesn't get followed. So we'd say follow the science, this is a deadly disease, and then the WHO publish, you know, the wide-ranging meta-study by John Ioannidis that shows the infection fatality rate of COVID to be between 0.15% and 0.2% in the envelope of bad flu, and suddenly, well, we won't follow the science quite so much on that one. You know, so even within that quite limited range of science, including some of those, you know, bodies like the WHO, let's not forget, you could be actually banned from Facebook or Twitter for contradicting. It seems fine when convenient to do so for governments to ignore them.
With your background in the English departments, what do you make of the way that that the use of the language has changed over the years. Did you see anything coming in, you know, when you were there that troubled you, that maybe that the language was being abused? Because I certainly did, you know, working as a journalist in broadcasting, quite a few times that made me deeply disturbed that actually the broadcast networks were being used for something like a kind of abusive system by which people would be told what to think rather than informed about what was going on. But anyway, your experiences in these English departments, what did you see there?
Well, I mean, what you were seeing is something that had probably been happening since the 1970s, which is the rise of critical theory, which...
Well, that sounds good.
Yeah, and some of it is good. Some of it is useful. But it, in the end, what I felt, what I saw, was a fairly intolerant system that, while preaching tolerance and diversity, wanted nothing to do with tolerance or diversity, at least not diversity of opinion, at least not open debate on many things. And this isn't true of everybody, and it wouldn't be fair to say that. But I think universities were, and are, particularly within the humanities departments, became far less interesting places because there wasn't the room for those other voices. I mean, recently I've been looking at some of the essays of C.S. Lewis, which are really relevant to what we're looking at now. I mean, 'cause I can remember I was teaching medieval and Renaissance literature, and I it was quite controversial for me to actually give my classes an essay by C.S. Lewis. Terribly old-fashioned, you know, to give him that. But I would say, well, look, it's beautifully written. The man understood, had been through the archive, understood the language. You know, there's a lot to be learned from it. But it would be frowned upon because it wasn't within that theoretical orthodoxy, you know, which we see sort of have political expression through things like critical race theory. You know, gender politics, identity politics, that's what had entered into the academy. It's a very good book, actually, by James Lindsay and Helen Pluckrose, called Cynical Theories, which deals with this. I'd really recommend that to anybody. That would give you a far better idea than I can now in a short period of time. But as I said, I've been looking at C.S. Lewis, and I think despite the sort of scientific non-debates that we've seen in the last 18 months, I think there were sort of broader philosophical questions that we're probably failing to ask. I've seen a few people ask them. I mean, you, to a certain extent, you would have got it from, I'm trying to think of his name now. He's going to clean up my mind. But the judge, former High Court judge, Lord Sumption, who did ask some of these questions. And that's about the place of science anyway in the formation of policy. You know, science seems to have become, and Lewis could see this coming very clearly, as could G.K. Chesterton, actually, about 20 years before. But this idea of this sort of materialist, scientific, technocratic way of ruling, where science became a mandate, scientific advice, instead of being just that, one consideration amongst others for a politician, became a mandate for action or impelled action. And I think we've seen that. And I think we've seen that over quite a few issues. And I mean, again, go back to climate change. It's very much what has happened there. You know, I mean, I've got a quote here. I would, the ones to read by Lewis, if anybody is interested, would be an essay called Is Progress Possible, which is from a collection of essays called God in the Dock. And there's also a monograph that he wrote called The Abolition of Man, both about sort of technocracy, scientism, eugenics. But the quote that I think is relevant to us now is he's talking about technocracy, and he identifies obviously that the government is increasingly and perhaps always has been oligarchic, but he says that the new oligarchy must more and more base its claim to planets on its claim to knowledge. If we are to be mothered, mother must know best. This means they must increasingly rely on the advice of scientists, till in the end the politicians proper become merely the scientist puppets. Technocracy is the form to which planned society must tend. I dread government in the name of science. That is how tyrannies come in. In every age, the man who wants us under their thumb, if they have any sense, will put forward the particular pretension which the hopes and fears of that age render most potent. They cash in. It has been magic. It has been Christianity. Now it will certainly be science. Perhaps the real scientists may not think much of the tyrant's science. They didn't think much of Hitler's racial theories or Stalin's biology, but they can be muzzled. And he wrote that in 1958. Very prescient, and I mean beautifully expressed. You wouldn't see, I don't think, anything in our mainstream media that would come close to that.
No, you're right. No, nothing. I mean, in fact, it's the opposite. It's dumbed down. But, you know, there's also talk of the Brave New World, Aldous Huxley, and obviously 1984, George Orwell. In the 1950s, there was a sort of almost a kind of aftershock from World War II, with a lot of writers and thinkers not quite happy with the way it all ended up.
Indeed. And I mean, at the risk of sounding like C.S. Lewis's literary agent, should probably add to that his novel, scientific novel, he called it an adult fairy tale, called That Hideous Strength. And I would...
That's about a university, isn't it? It's actually about
a sort
of horrible, malevolent influence in a university, which in a way, of course, is exactly where we are today.
He identified it very early on. As I say, to go back even further, worth reading or rereading now at the moment is the works of G.K. Chesterton. For our current situation, I think a reading of Eugenics and Other Evils that certainly bears rereading. Pick out a quick quote there from him. And what he identified again was a materialist scientism that he saw increasingly dominating the politics of his day. But what he was also commenting on, which I think is something else that we've seen, is the erosion of any checks on government. You know, if government can justify itself by science as its truth claim, in the way that it would use religion once, there's nothing to check it either in the media, as we said, because the media have been entirely complicit, haven't asked any of the difficult questions. You know, there is no fourth estate. They haven't served that purpose during this period and for quite a long time, really. They have on some issues, you know. We could look at things like the Gulf War. We could look at things like, you know, the wars following 9/11. There was some questioning, less on climate change, it would have to be said, and virtually none on this. There's been a degradation of that hold into account.
So what was Chesterton saying about eugenics? That definitely sounds interesting. This whole idea of trying to genetically engineer the human population to come up with this kind of master race that was an idea which was actually largely British and American until Hitler took it up, in which case in the 50s and 60s it suddenly became a toxic word.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. I mean, you know, he was looking at something that was really quite respectable amongst his contemporaries. And he names names. He refers to George Bernard Shaw, Bertrand Russell, others in that quite short work, actually. And it's available online. I mean, I shouldn't say this, but if you Google it with, you know, eugenics and other evils, PDF, it comes up. And you can have a read through it for free. I mean, to give you like a little flavour of it, this is 1922. The thing that is that really is trying to tyrannize through government is science. The thing that really does use the secular arm is science. And the creed that really is levying tithes and capturing schools, the creed that really is enforced by fine and imprisonment, the creed that really is proclaimed not in sermons but in statutes and spread not by pilgrims but by policemen, that creed is the great but disputed system of thought which began with evolution and has ended in eugenics. Materialism is really our established church, for the government will really help it to persecute its heretics. Vaccination, in its 100 years of experiment, has been disputed almost as much as baptism in its approximate 2000. But it seems quite natural to our politicians to enforce vaccination, and it would seem to them madness to enforce baptism. 1922, just 99 years ago, just under 100 years.
Well, it's, I mean, you know what, he's there, he's characterising the real danger as, in fact, C.S. Lewis too, as using science as a religion. But as you've just said, they just drop this whole thing when it suits them.
Exactly. So, you know, it is a movable feast, and it's, well, it's scientism, isn't it? Because it's some science, not all science. We're not going to look at all evidence. We're going to look at this evidence. Now, either science is, you know, completely open, obviously outside the realms of absurdity, or, you know, it isn't science. It's religion.
Well, I mean, the other thing, of course, is it's it is a potentially science is just used to con people. You know, we've had I can remember looking at the whole thing of DNA testing in order to send people to prison. You know, so there may be no other evidence apart from some DNA evidence.
Yeah.
Send someone to jail for life. You know, that's the sort of thing that disturbs me, where science is being used literally as if it is the gospel truth. Now, I can remember,
and to take it a step further, of course, I mean, if you want to include the science of, you know, psychology or psychiatry, that you can pathologize dissent, and that way you don't have to argue at all, because you're just saying, well, poor chappy's insane.
Well, I mean, I hopefully we're flagging up, you know, five stars on all their systems right now. You and I have even daring to have this conversation. But I know I had a Jewish physics teacher doing my A-level back in the late 1970s. And Martin Black, he said to me, he said one of the first lessons we had, because he was very into philosophy of science. And he said, look, before we start embark on the next 2 years of all this stuff, he said, anyone that ever tells you that science knows what's going on is lying to you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because, and he quoted various theories over the years that one by one have been found to be just theories, and they were workable theories. They work fairly well, but they're not actually telling you what's really going on. And sometimes those theories don't take long to be completely overturned.
Well, that's it, isn't it? I mean, you could excuse politicians if, you know, with science we were in the bright light of some new dawn, and it hadn't been with us for several hundred years, with a catalogue of, you know, catastrophic errors in some cases. You know, you could look at Lysenkoism in Soviet Russia. You could look at, you know, Nazi racial science, which grew out of eugenics, which we were just discussing.
But hang on, what's this Lysenkoism? I've never come across that before.
Okay, well, Lysenkoism was essentially a theory which was applied to Soviet architecture and ended up killing probably millions of people. And I mean, I won't go into it too deeply now, but it basically became illegal to criticize it. I mean, I can give you, you know, if you just Google it again, you'll get a good overview of what it was.
But that's your favorite search engine, not necessarily Google.
Or whatever one, or a search engine of your choice. But it was basically a Soviet scientist called Trofim Lysenko, who, it was against genetics and science-based agriculture. It was a very strange kind of, it's a form of, I think it's called Lamarckism. But anyway, it was a dead-end theory that ended up causing absolute chaos and tragedy. But, you know, it's an example that at the time it was illegal, and to criticise it, and there were other scientists, opposing scientists who found themselves on a train to Siberia, you know, as a result. Your science is replete with catastrophic error. I mean, even our very own Neil Ferguson has far from an unblotted copybook, it would be fair to say.
Yeah, this is the modeler, sponsored by Bill Gates, sponsored by Imperial College.
Yeah, who's been right on anything, as far as I'm aware.
To be fair to the guy, he would say, well, the reason that we didn't get the model that I predicted, the disaster model, was because of the lockdowns.
Now, that's what's called, I think there's a few different words for it, but there's the old story of, the tribal elder who has hung around his neck a little whistle. And a little boy asks him one day, he says, what's that whistle hanging around your neck? He said, that's the lion whistle. What does that do? He said, well, if I blow the lion whistle, it keeps the lions away. And the little boy says, but there are no lions around here. Aha, you see, it works.
with all this talk of religion and yet not actually sticking to it, it does seem to me that there isn't really any kind of rationality to what's going on at all. So where are we heading with all this? Do you think there's any light at the end of the tunnel?
Well, like I say, I think if anything, it may rekindle some of these debates that had sort of lain dormant for a long time. That's if we don't all just get accused of being fascists, because, of course, C.S. Lewis was a well-known fascist. but I think if we can rekindle some of these ways of thinking, because we always get sold by, I mean, it's the main argument of tyrants is inevitability. This must happen. Because this has happened, this must happen. And the question we have to ask is, must it? And the other thing that they like to say, they like to push the myth of progress, that, and this is paraphrasing Chesterton, really, you can't turn the clock back. Well, of course, you can turn the clock back because it's a mechanism made by man and you can turn it back. The other phrase would be, you've made your bed, you've got to lie on it. Well, no, I could get up and remake the bed, couldn't I? So they'll push this idea of inevitability, of progress, of this is the way it must go. But, of course, that's just ideological. That's just rhetoric.
For instance, saying you can't turn the clock back when you're looking at the Thatcher era means you can't renationalise anything. Well, actually,
of course you can.
All you need to do is to fail to renew all these various franchises of all these rackets that they've got in it, electricity racket, railway racket, the bus racket.
We have in our hands, the sum total of all political and social arrangements that have ever occurred in human experience. We've got all of those and could at any time choose any of them. Some of them would be disastrous. I mean, we could choose in Merthyr or under our council to reinstall the patriarchal system of a, Northern Highlands led. I mean, it would be bloody disastrous, but we could do it. There's nothing, So, I mean, that idea of it is all, and there is this kind of neophile, love of the new, it must be new, change, new, something innovative.
Well,
and
the
new.
Other thing that's happening at the moment.
Sometimes that's bloody disastrous.
Well, it's a kind of cult of youth as well at the moment.
Yeah, and that comes with that, doesn't it? Because possibly partly, I don't want to insult youth in any way. I was one myself once. But I think it's fair to say that you don't know a great deal at that age. I could look back at myself. I can remember Dennis Potter, the old TV writer, saying that you should look back on your youth with a tender contempt. You should always be tender, but there must be the contempt. And, you're full of a kind of often mad idealism for ideas that sound wonderful because you really don't know anything about them or much else.
The thing is that a tendency towards trying to stifle criticism and stifle discussion, debate, I mean, that is formalised with the BBC, for example, saying we are not going to have anybody on who will criticise. In fact, I was told this by Joe House, who's the head of climate science here at Bristol University, when I suggested that she might like to spend an hour debating, is climate change really man-made, with Piers Corbyn. She said, well, the BBC don't allow any kind of debate about this. And, of course, I looked it up, and she's quite right. They don't.
They've exempted that from their charter responsibility to provide balance.
No balance.
Impartiality. Allowed in which, there, of course, means that it's not science, then.
Yeah, Joe won the debate with Piers because he kept interrupting too much, and maybe I'm interrupting you a bit too much. But I do want to also look at this, the whole aspect of China, because this is something that we've seen, you know, almost a kind of Chinafication of the West going on with the idea that, for example, the laws now formally passed and now in Hong Kong too, that if you criticise President Xi, you can do up to, I think it's three and a half years in prison just simply for raising a question about President Xi. Mm. And, you know, really, really infantile things like...
I mean, what I'd say on that is...
laughing at the national anthem is another prison sentence.
Yeah, I mean, what I'd say about that is, I mean, I'm not Chinese and it's none of my business. I can't really do much about what happens in China either, and wouldn't want to if the Chinese people... content or discontent with their lot need to sort it out themselves, really. It's not my lookout. I live here, and I'll be blaming my government for what they do. I'll be looking at who might be influencing them to do what they do and then acting accordingly. But as for China, China was a model. China was, which it might well be, you know, it's a technocratic state like a lot of, you know, central command economies and states. There have been many in the past. China isn't the first one. I don't think you'd have got very far laughing at the national anthem in Nazi Germany. You probably wouldn't have got very far if you wrote a satire about Stalin. You know, there's nothing new about that, but I don't particularly want to see that obviously coming here. And I think we can see the sort of, wouldn't call them green shoots, would you, but the brown or blackened shoots of that particular tree starting to sprout. And, you know, there's no doubt that there are those in politics and in power, certainly, who would like to have that type of control. I just don't think that that's commensurate with our history or what our, you know, you know, it has been. You know, we can't pretend that we've got an unblemished history.
I mean, anybody that embarks on that road is surely going to end up at a civil war.
It's hard to know where you'd end up. You can see that there are, for me, I think a lot of what has been pushed in the last year, I think a lot of what has been pushed by through climate change has been looking at ways that they can somehow monitor or increasingly justify the monitoring of individuals, their movement, their consumption, all of those other things. So that would come through some kind of electronic ID. It would be similar to the social crediting system of China, which is probably why, you know, China comes up. But, you know, I think that is the thing we need to resist. There are all sorts of attendant dangers on the road to that. I mean, I think there are a lot of dangers, huge dangers, in this current scare quotes vaccination push. You know, I think, as you said, I think it's ignored huge amounts of evidence. I think that claims have been made to safety that can't possibly be known on such a short-term analysis. But I'm less able to comment fully on that. I can have my sense of that. But I think, you know, what we really need to avoid is that sort of overarching full spectrum dominance, technocratic control of individuals in that way, whatever justification is offered for that. And
yeah, I mean, it does seem that this kind of surveillance society has been kind of happening by stealth in the West, whereas at least the, you know, the Chinese, like Margaret Thatcher, are open about what they're up to.
Yeah, I'm not sure quite how stealthy it's been. You know, I think it's the justifications for it that, you know, a perhaps they just seem so unlikely, you know, that these oligarchs and corporations should claim to do it because they care about the planet and human life. That just to me seems implausible, but people seem to believe it.
Well, we've also had this whole sort of devolution to the Welsh government. Have you noticed that? Do you think actually that they've done a reasonable job down at the Senedd or not?
It depends on what issue, really. It's hard to say. I think they've been as disastrous on COVID policy as anybody else. I think they're as foolish and biddable on climate change as anybody else. That would be a case-by-case basis, wouldn't it, really? I mean, I think, you know, the problem is, I mean, devolution, independence and sovereignty are three different things. I think that's something that people don't separate out in their minds very well. I mean, you know, from devolution, we've got quite a large campaign for independence in Wales now. That's fine, but it's a kind of empty term, isn't it? What do you mean by independence? You know, you could say, well, you know, we're part of the, you could be a unionist, or, you know, you could be for independence, but that's kind of like saying I'm walking upstairs or I'm walking downstairs. It depends what you're walking there for, really.
Yeah, and of course, you know, the Irish fought for independence and then joined Brussels, and so they became part of a different, you know, not independent.
Exactly, and a great, you know, the main independence party in Wales is vehemently pro-EU. You know, as is Sinn Féin.
Yes. Amazing.
So, you know, I don't know what Michael Collins would have thought of it. I don't know what, I'm pretty sure what you would have thought of it, actually. Or the various others who, you know, died for Ireland. Or what the earlier sort of philosophers of Welsh independence would have thought of it. Not a lot, I suspect.
I know you've done a sort of poem for us this week, Ian, yeah, which is very kind of you, especially since I saw you ranting away on social media about the state of our politics, and you know, at least you managed to bring a smile to my face, recognizing you know, echoes in my own heart of some of the sentiments you're expressing. So
I'm not expressing them at the moment, Tony, because I'm on a 30-day ban from Facebook once again.
Oh God, thanks, Facebook.
Why? I shared a meme that showed an image of Joseph Mengele with an explanation of the meme, which was about his total lack of ethics. What the meme said was, follow the science, Joseph Mengele. And I said, well, you know, there's no proof of him actually having said this, but given his total lack of ethics and, you know, murderous monomania in pursuing his experiments, inhumane experiments against, you know, people in the concentration camps, he might well have said it. It was flagged up and I was told that I was promoting Joseph Mengele. Now, to take from that I was promoting the ideas of Joseph Mengele is a hell of a stretch.
Well, it's just not true.
It's just not true, yeah. In any way, shape or form. And, you know, it's the likes of Mengele and that way of thinking of making humans less than human that I most object to. So it's ironic, isn't it, that the Facebook, I don't know if it was a human being who did that or some algorithm, who bloody knows these days, eh? But it's inaccurate, so I'll just say for the record, in case anybody was any doubt, I am not a supporter of the Nazis or of Nazi racial science. Yeah, I'm sure it's a big shock to all my friends to find that out about me.
Well, so the AI bot on Facebook missed that by 1,000 miles.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to send that one back to the factory or the blueprints again. I think we need to be re-looked at for that. Anyway, look, before we hear your poem, is it still possible to follow you anywhere on social media since your Facebook ban?
I might pop up on Twitter now and again. It's unlikely. I don't like Twitter. Twitter just reminds me of a kind of electronic. It's like the electronic online version of a drunken fight in a pub car park. So I don't go on there a lot. Not Facebook is much more civilized. But I think I'll probably be trying to write a couple of articles, something with a bit more length to it.
Do you have a blog or anything, Ian?
I don't at the moment, but I'm looking to set something up and possibly maybe do some kind of, you know, sort of vlog thing.
And what about your political festival over there in Merthyr? Is that happening or is it allowed to happen?
Well, thereby hangs a tale. I haven't been a director of the festival for about 3 years. There was, I actually resigned as a director because there was an attack on some of the speakers that we had 1 year and a decision was made to withdraw them. That includes Patrick Henningsen, Vanessa Bailey. I defended them at the time and the decision was made to withdraw them and it was a very concerted attack on them. And in the end, I resigned. But also there was a family illness at the time and it wasn't a good time for me. But it may be that I'll be doing an alternative festival, a sort of fringe festival along with it this year, next year, if it happens, if we're not locked down. And if I'm not in some kind of quarantine camp in the Outer Hebrides, then you may see something there. My idea for the festival is something called Agora, which is a little Welsh pun, Agor, and then there'll be a little at symbol. Agor means open in Welsh, and that will be a very sort of open debate on, well, all the kind of things we've touched on tonight.
Right.
Hope you come along, Tony. If I do get to do it, I'd hope you come along.
Obviously, only if I'm allowed by Mr. Drakeford.
Well, we'll have to see. You may have to wear a mask, a visor, possibly a hazmat suit by then.
I know.
And vaccinated 15 times.
I know. I've seen the satellite photos. They've got about 50 police cars permanently on the border waiting on all the little roads just in case anyone should stray across. And they've also got with the Red Dragon ticket inspectors on all the trains as they cross the border. Yeah. Going but down and making sure that the masks are on. And if, of course, you don't have a mask, you'll be handcuffed and dragged into the goods wagon at the back of the train. So it is a bit of, you know, this is independence for you.
That's independence. And I would just like to say at this point, Tony, I love the beloved leader and I do not question any of his policies.
Okay.
Please do not come for me. Please.
It's Ian Jenkins. Before you do your poem, I'd just like to say thanks ever so much for joining us again, Ian. And over to you.
Thanks, Tony. Okay. Well, this one's called The Politician. Probably not all politicians. Perhaps it should be called The Bad Politician or The Modern Politician. What a terrible gift in the darkest way to be drenched in blood yet remain so grey. To make each word a soporific when each thing said is so horrific. To wring the hands and damp the eyes. To mask the void that lies inside. And all the while excuse vile acts with ersatz virtue and confected facts.